You know, I looked and I realized that everything I'd written, everything that I'd studied on the resurrection, there was personal agenda and bias involved. So I started to doubt my Christian faith, thinking, well, you know, maybe Jesus didn't rise from the dead. Maybe I've brainwashed myself into this. After all, I was brought up in a Christian family. I went to a Christian university. This is really all I know. If I'd been brought up in a Muslim country or Hindu country, would I embrace a different worldview? And I really wrestled with it. My wife, my closest friends can vouch how much I agonized over this, but it became a quest for truth.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. We're continuing our series on the resurrection. We've been focusing especially in these programs on the resurrection claim itself, its place in the wider biblical story. Of course, that raises the question of the reliability of the story, the New Testament accounts that proclaim the resurrection as a historical fact at the heart of the gospel. So in the next few programs, we're going to camp out on that question with the help of Michael Lacona. Mike is a New Testament scholar, historian, and Christian apologist, a professor at Houston Baptist University. His most recent book is a hefty volume titled The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach, published by IVP Academic. Now, I'm always skeptical of subtitles like that. After all, there have been countless searches for the historical Jesus. What makes this one different? But it is different, actually, and an enormously helpful resource. I don't agree with all of his exegetical conclusions, but what I really like about the book is the way he defends the reliability of Scripture from a historical perspective in light of his considerable reading in comparable Greek and Roman biography writing of the time. Why is that important? It's important because from the earliest days, Christians have argued that their doctrines are rooted in historical facts, and that if those facts are found to be fictitious or rooted in various forms of deception, then, as St. Paul says, we of all men are most to be pitied. If Christ isn't risen, then our faith is in vain. So without any further ado, let me introduce Mike to you, part one of our conversation on the resurrection of Jesus, a new historiographical approach. Michael Lacona is the president of Risen Jesus, Inc. He's a frequent speaker at university campuses and has engaged in numerous public debates with opponents to the resurrection, including two such opportunities with Bart Ehrman. Michael Lacona, thanks so much for being with us on the White Horse Inn and helping us think through some of the debates surrounding the resurrection.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be here.
First, we were talking just a moment ago before we started about your own background. What brought you to the place where you'd write a 700-page volume containing basically the best arguments and resources on the resurrection?
Well, I had engaged in writing and speaking on the historical evidence for Jesus' resurrection for a few years and decided to go for a doctorate in it. And what led me to that was Gary Habermas and I had just finished writing The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus. And after that was over, I said to Gary, hey, you know, Doc, you have this bibliography, which at that point I think was 2,200 or 2,400 academic resources written on the resurrection. And I said, so you know where scholars stand on this. How many of these scholars are actual historians? I mean, what do they actually do? And he says, well, the most of them are biblical scholars. You have a few philosophers, and you might just have a handful of professional historians outside the community of biblical scholars. Only one book treatment, and a very small one at that. And so I said, well, that's interesting. So nothing exhaustive had been done according to, let's say, strictly controlled historical method as a professional historian living outside and working outside the community of biblical scholars would do. What would such an investigation look like? So I decided, well, that's what I'd want to do. I'd want to see what that would look like. And so I'd have to learn how historians do their work. And it wasn't long in the process, you know, a year or less, when the philosophers of history I was studying were saying there is no such thing as a neutral historian, and our own personal biases can corrupt the integrity of our investigation. You know, I looked and I realized that everything I'd written, everything that I'd studied on the resurrection, there was personal agenda and bias involved. And it didn't mean my conclusion was necessarily mistaken, but it could mean that the process by which I arrived at those conclusions had been corrupted, which means my conclusion could have been corrupted. So I started to, you know, doubt my Christian faith quite a bit at that point and thinking, well, you know, maybe Jesus didn't rise from the dead. Maybe I've brainwashed myself into this. After all, I was brought up in a Christian family. I went to a Christian university. This is really all I know. Hmm. If I'd been brought up in a Muslim country or Hindu country or, say, China, an atheist country, would I embrace a different worldview? And, hey, if this could mean my eternity to get this right, how could I go wrong? So the objective of my investigation changed. The original objective of my investigation, Michael, was to look at the evidence and try to build a historical case for the resurrection of Jesus using the tools of historians. That changed to now I was really trying to look at this in as objective a manner as possible. And I really wrestled with it. My wife, my closest friends can vouch for how much I agonized over this, but it became a quest for truth.
A personal quest.
A personal quest.
Not just an ivory tower academic pursuit, but something that you personally needed to settle.
Yes. It wasn't an apologetic for me anymore. It was an honest journey for truth.
You've had some interesting conversations with Bart Ehrman, the former evangelical who came out rabidly opposed to historic Christian claims, particularly the resurrection. You've had a couple of debates with Bart Ehrman. How would you characterize those interactions?
Friendly and spirited.
Those are the best, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, I like Bart. I do. I like him as a person. He's the kind of guy you can hang out with, have a beer, and just have a good time. I like him. I think he's wrong on a ton of things, but I like him, and we've always had a good time together.
That's fantastic. You think that this is the most common objection in our day to the claim of a historic resurrection, even a historic Jesus, that the New Testament Gospels are late and unreliable texts, which for a variety of reasons just can't be trusted.
Yeah.
Just sheer distance. So long ago, and you hear over and over again, the texts have been corrupted. Do you think that's probably the biggest assumption that people make? And I say assumption because a lot of people don't test it. They just assume it.
Yeah, well, I'd say that some of them, Bart Ehrman and many others, give five major objections. So I've called them the ABCs, Ds, and Es of the Gospels. A's for authorship, B, bias, C, contradictions, D, dating. Like you were saying there, they're written too far after the events they purport to describe. And E, eyewitness. There's no eyewitness testimony, or they weren't written by eyewitnesses. Those, I think, would be the five major objections. I have a lecture called the ABCs, Ds, and Es of Defending the Gospels, in which I address all five of those objections. But if you'd like to cover any or all of them, I'm happy to do that.
You often hear higher critical or liberal views of the origin of the Gospels in secular college courses on cable TV. Countless books on sale in your local Barnes & Noble. For example, in his best-selling book, Zealot, writer Reza Aslan argues that, quote, the most widely accepted theory of the formation of the Gospels, the two-source theory, holds that Mark's account was written first, sometime after 70 AD, about four decades after Jesus' death. Mark's focus is kept squarely on Jesus' ministry. He's uninterested either in Jesus' birth or, perhaps surprisingly, in Jesus' resurrection, as he writes nothing at all about either event. Can you unpack some of the assumptions behind a statement like that and then maybe walk our listeners through some good reasons to challenge these basic claims about Mark's gospel?
Well, first of all, Reza's mistaken when he says, well, he's correct when he says the majority of scholars today, New Testament scholars, and I'd say maybe the majority of them are not believers. They're not Christians, you know. I'm a member of the Society of Biblical Literature, which has, I forgot how many thousand, 8,500 scholars and students who are members. Evangelicals or conservatives would be in the minority by far. And this would be, you know, Old Testament, New Testament things. You have Jewish and all kinds of scholars in this. But when you talk about the world of New Testament scholarship, I would say the majority of scholars do embrace the two-source hypothesis, which would be the Markan priority. Mark was written first, and then another source, which is the hypothetical Q source, which, as you know, Michael, tries to account for how Matthew and Luke have common tradition between them, a lot of times word for word, that's absent from Mark. So you have to account for that. Is Luke using Matthew as a source, Matthew using Luke as a source, or do they have a common source that they are using, and most scholars believe that they're using a common source. And Q is just an abbreviation for the German word, as you know, Quelle, which just means source. So it's kind of like saying X, you know, that's all it is. So yeah, that is the majority position. Where Reza is mistaken, as he says, the majority of scholars say that it was dated, or Mark was written after the year 70. That's false. The overwhelming majority of New Testament scholars say that Mark was written somewhere between 65 and 70. That someplace that even earlier, like, for example, James Crossley, an agnostic New Testament scholar, he puts Mark in the 40s. Hmm. But the majority of scholars between 65 and 70, not too many would put it after 70. You did mention something, though, how you said Mark was not concerned with the resurrection of Jesus.
Yeah, Reza Aslan's point.
Yeah. Well, if that were the case, then why does Mark have Jesus predict his death and resurrection
right.
several times throughout the gospel?
Now, a lot of people base that argument, particularly in relation to the resurrection, on the lack of so-called longer ending to Mark's gospel. But even if you take out that longer ending, which seems entirely appropriate to do, witnesses arrive at the empty tomb and are confronted by an angel who says in verses 6 and 7, "He's not here, he has risen, go and tell his disciples." So you still have, even in the shorter, undisputed ending of Mark's gospel, the resurrection, don't you?
That's correct. And notice what else the angel says. In verse 8, he says, "Go and tell the disciples and Peter that he, Jesus, is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you." And you go back to chapter 14, verse 28, and Jesus says, "After I have risen, I will go ahead of you to Galilee, and there you will see me." One of his latest predictions of his death and resurrection is Mark 14, 28. And the angel in chapter 16, verse 8, is reminding them of that prediction.
You just see, don't you, a huge set of assumptions, particularly ever since the rise of higher criticism, that early testimony to Jesus just has to represent him as a Boy Scout troop leader. If you get anything that smacks of the Jesus of John's gospel, for example, it just has to be a later interpolation. That's no way to do history, is it?
No. You got to look at the text in its own context. And most people don't understand Mark. They're not reading it according to its genre, which is Greco-Roman biography. And it really makes me smile when you have scholars who will say that Mark does not present Jesus as the divine Son of God. Mark is crystal clear that Jesus is God in some sense.
Reza Aslan goes on to argue that, quote, 2 decades after Mark's successors, between 90 and 100 CE, the authors of Matthew and Luke, working independently of each other and with Mark's manuscript as a template, updated the gospel story by adding their own unique traditions. So let's move from Mark to Matthew for a moment in the light of that comment. What's a good reason to believe that Matthew was written much earlier than 90 AD?
Well, I don't know too many scholars who would put it that late. I mean, that's pretty late. But of course, Reza is putting Mark post-70, yeah, which not many scholars do. So he's taking a more of a skeptical view, more skeptical than critical scholars generally do. Again, they're going to date Matthew and Luke earlier than that.
When we think about presuppositions, particularly in relation to Matthew's gospel, one of the things that strikes me is how frequently it's just assumed that if you have, for example, Jesus predicting the fall of Jerusalem, which occurred in 70 AD, it had to have been after the fact. So basically, anything that smacks of predictive prophecy, events that are actually fulfilled in the near future, have to be later interpolations. Is that an example of sort of the presuppositions governing the exploration?
Everybody's going to put their presuppositions
sure.
in there. What we have to do is examine them.
Yeah.
Of course, we're all going to have biases, and so certain presuppositions are what we conclude, and how we read a text according to those presuppositions are going to seem more plausible to us according to those presuppositions than they will to others who don't have those same presuppositions. When I look at Matthew, he makes statements such as in Matthew 28, where it says, "The Jews went around saying that the disciples stole the body, and they continue to do so to this very day," right? So whenever Matthew's writing, whether it's in the 60s, which would have been about 30 years after Jesus' resurrection, or if it were in the 80s, which would have been 50 years after the resurrection, Matthew is saying, "Hey, you guys know that they're doing this. They are continuing to say this, that the disciples stole the body. They're continuing to say this to this very day. You well know.
Which is in the Jewish sources.
That's right. If Matthew was written after 70, why wouldn't, when he says, he makes these predictions, Jesus does, about the fall of Jerusalem, why wouldn't he make a statement saying, and you know this happened? He doesn't. So now, that is kind of an argument from silence, so we can only go so far with that. But since he does it on another occasion, you know, you would think we could expect something like there on such a major prophecy. But he doesn't do that. So I don't know. I find some of those things curious and seem to me to suggest an earlier date for Matthew.
What's your view of Luke's reference to the many other narratives that have been compiled, as he puts it? Is he referring to Matthew and Mark, or do you think that he's aware of other gospels or perhaps that Q source lost to us?
That's a good question. We just don't know. And the term many, how he uses that throughout the gospels and Acts, it's hard to determine how many meant to him. Did it just mean two, or did it mean five or ten? We don't know.
But it at least underscores, doesn't it, that it's not just oral tradition in those intervening years, but written.
That's correct. So you got Matthew there. It could refer to some lost sources. And notice he doesn't put down those sources. He's just saying he's going to try to construct his account in an orderly manner.
By going back and actually interviewing people who are still alive and were eyewitnesses.
That's correct. He does say he got his information from the eyewitnesses, those who were with Jesus and heard directly from him.
It's interesting, especially in light of Luke's appeal to eyewitness testimony, that again, a writer like Reza Aslan can say, the readers of Luke's gospel, like most people in the ancient world, didn't make a sharp distinction between myth and reality. They were less interested in what actually happened than in what it meant. It would have been perfectly normal, indeed expected, for a writer in the ancient world to tell tales of gods and heroes whose fundamental facts would have been recognized as false, but whose underlying message would have been seen as true. What do you make of that assertion? Particularly when you have the Apostle Paul saying, if Christ is not raised, then we are of all people to be pitied. Or Peter saying, we didn't follow cleverly devised myths, but were eyewitnesses of these events. Are they going against what Aslan states here, even if you say that they didn't see what happened? They believed they were. They stated they were. And Aslan is saying, they didn't even see themselves as writing that kind of history.
Yeah, well, that's just crazy. I mean, that's really easily refuted, Michael. And first of all, Paul does talk about Jesus' resurrection. Oh, by the way, you know, if you're going to say, well, Mark didn't know about the resurrection, you pointed out how the angel announces Jesus' resurrection. We discussed how Jesus predicted his resurrection. But then we also have to recognize that Paul wrote prior to Mark's gospel. And the resurrection was certainly going around at that point. And if Acts is correct, John Mark, who wrote Mark's gospel, had been a traveling companion with Paul. And so he would have certainly heard Paul speak about the resurrection of Jesus. So there's no reason to believe that Mark wouldn't have known about the resurrection. To just say across the board, nobody would have believed these things, I think is a little naive.
Isn't it kind of anachronistic, too, imposing a kind of Protestant liberal dualism between fact and value on the way people would have read those texts, especially when Luke says, hey, Theophilus, I'm composing this orderly account by interviewing eyewitnesses. So the genre itself is going to be a business-like process.
That's correct. Yeah.
Let's talk about the most controversial gospel of all, the Gospel of John, with its highly developed presentation of Christ, its so-called high Christology. Most liberal scholars, with the assumption that I was talking about earlier, say that this has to be a late gospel, not just later than the synoptics, but really late, because it represents a transition from an early Jesus who is a rabbi to a kind of Greek god. And what do you make of that? And where do you place John in the development of the gospel traditions?
Well, I do believe, with most scholars, that the Gospel of John does contain eyewitness testimony from one of Jesus' disciples. Was it written by John, the son of Zebedee? I don't know. I think it was, okay? But I understand that a lot of great minds would disagree with that. Most scholars today say, no, it wasn't written by John, the son of Zebedee. Richard Baucom thinks it was written by a minor disciple of Jesus. Ben Witherington thinks it was written by Lazarus, perhaps. I think there's some interesting, some good arguments that can be put forth for that, but I'm more persuaded that it was John, the son of Zebedee. But even most scholars, even though they reject the traditional authorship of John, the son of Zebedee, they still agree that one of Jesus' disciples provided much of the source material that was used for John's gospel. So we've got that. Do we have developing Christology and theology in there? I do think we have greater theological reflections in John's gospel than we have in the others. I'm glad.
But nothing that contradicts the synoptic.
Oh, no, account. Not at all. Nothing that contradicts the synoptics. And I think one of the problems or mistakes that many skeptical scholars make is to say that John has this extremely high, full-blown Christology of Jesus as God, and we don't find that in the other gospels. Well, I do think we find it in the other gospels, even Mark.
In those gospels, we have Jesus being crucified on the charge of blasphemy for forgiving sins.
And that's true.
Only God can do this.
Only God can forgive sins. And you bring up an interesting thing. So the objective of ancient biography, according to Plutarch, in the first chapter of his Life of Alexander the Great, distinguishes biography from history. Now, they're both reporting history, you could say, but a history as a genre was not focused on a person. It was focused on an event, an era, a kingdom, a war, something like that. It's a longer period of time. Whereas a biography was focused on a person. And he says, look, the objective behind writing a biography, which they called lives then, not a biography, the objective behind a life is to illuminate the character of the main person here. And so when you take that and you read the Gospels in light of that, just start with Mark, probably our earliest Gospel. Think of how it starts off. As Isaiah the prophet said, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight the paths of our God, you know, make straight his paths. Well, this isn't Jesus who is the voice of the one crying in the wilderness, preparing God's paths. It is John the Baptist. And who's he preparing the way for? Jesus, whom the Old Testament in that context is referring to as God. That's how the Gospel of Mark starts. That's chapter one. Then you come to chapter two and you get to the healing of the paralytic where Jesus first forgives his sins, as you mentioned, and the Jews respond, wait, that's blasphemy. Only God can forgive sins. Yep. Chapter four, chapter five, chapter six, you got stuff going on like Jesus is crossing the lake and he's fallen asleep and they wake him up and he commands the wind and the waves to be silenced and to be calm. And they are. Well, the Old Testament says only God calms the wind.
And they even respond, who is this?
Who is
this? Who can even calm the wind, has power over the wind and the seas?
Later on, Jesus walks on water, right? But the Old Testament says only God walks on water. Jesus raises the dead by his own word. The Old Testament says only God can raise the dead. You say, well, wait a minute. You had other people like Peter, Paul. They raised the dead. Yes, but they did it based on the power of Jesus, that they would appeal to Jesus and say in the name of Jesus. Well, Jesus didn't appeal to anything. He just used his own power and word. So you got all this kind of stuff. And like you said, at Jesus' trial, who does Jesus claim to be? The Messiah, the Son of God, and the Son of Man. That's this apocalyptic Son of Man who's mentioned in Daniel chapter 7, who's worshipped and served as only God. The God who shares his glory with no one does so with this apocalyptic Son of Man in Daniel 7.
Yeah, the Son of Man. But people often think, well, Son of God means a claim of divinity, and you find that especially emphasized in John. But in the Synoptics, it's Son of Man. But actually, as you're pointing out, Son of Man was more redolent of his deity.
That's correct.
Because of Daniel. I'm the guy Daniel was talking about.
Yeah. And that's
coming
why
on the clouds of glory. And
that's why blasphemy was charged. He basically says, hey, you know that Son of Man in Daniel 7 is going to be worshipped and served as only God is? Well, that's me. And you're going to see me riding the clouds of heaven and being a co-occupant of God's throne. And my Father and I are made of the same stuff. And that's what the charge of blasphemy was. And that is the climax of Jesus' claims about himself. So when you look throughout the Gospel of Mark and you understand it as being of the genre of Greco-Roman biography, it's very clear that throughout the entire Gospel of Mark, Mark is proclaiming that Jesus is God in some sense. It's a Christology that is no different than we find in John. You got to realize, too, that Paul writes prior to any of the Gospels, and he has the same Christology as John does. So there's no evolution in the Christology that's going on at all.
So Jesus, if he's charged with blasphemy in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he's already being heard by his Jewish contemporaries as claiming deity. It's not, we'd be at a great loss if we didn't have the Gospel of John, but we would have the same Christology if we just had Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Oh, absolutely. The same Christology. And that would be made even more clear when you read Paul's letters, who came before any of the Gospels were written.
Yeah, some scholars have pointed to an interesting passage in chapter 5 of John's Gospel. We read, "Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed." John A.T. Robinson, liberal scholar, who ended up arriving at early dates for the Gospels based on purely historical considerations, pointed out, "This passage has three active verbs, which on the face of it seem to imply that this particular pool and the city of Jerusalem were still around at the time that this text was written. But we know from Josephus that the whole city was razed to the ground in 70 AD. So wouldn't one expect a text written decades after the fall of Jerusalem to speak of a pool that used to be in Jerusalem, had five columns, and so forth? What do you make of that particular argument?
I would say that there's what's called the historical present in Greek. The historical present, you would state something that occurred in the past, but you would use it in the present tense, so to add a sense of drama to the text, so that the readers get the sense that they're present, that they're there, they're part of the narrative. However, in this text, we don't have a historical present. Dan Wallace has done extensive work on this, and Dan shows that when you look at the grammatical structure of the present tense that's being used here, and you take that grammatical structure into consideration, Dan did a search through all of the extant Greek literature written within 200 years on each side of Jesus. And what he found is when you use this grammatical structure that John is using here in John chapter 5, these first couple of verses that talk about the porticos, the porches by the pool of Bethesda, that in every single case when this Greek grammatical construction is used, it is referring to something that is going on right now. It's not a historical present. They really mean to say that this is present right now. And so, you know, there can always be an exception to that. But from what we see from the use of this elsewhere, this would be the lone exception. And I think Dan makes a pretty decent argument that has not been answered by any scholars on why this would not strongly suggest that John's Gospel was written prior to the year 70. I mean, that's just really cool. It might even be our first Gospel to have been written, or maybe the second after Mark.
Yeah, fascinating argument. In terms of authorship, you pointed out the various possibilities there. It is striking, isn't it, that in this Gospel you have a lot of references to the third person, John 19:35, "He who saw it has borne witness. His testimony is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth." You often find references to the disciple who saw it, or the disciple whom Jesus loved. Is that sort of odd language for ancient biography if John were in fact the author?
Yeah, it is a little bit odd. You would think that if John's the author of it, that he would have said so, or he said, "I saw this."
So again, you're not questioning the scripture's own description of authorship here, when John's Gospel itself gives you reason to believe that it may have been written by somebody else.
Right. I do think, I don't know if it was John the son of Zebedee, I lean to the position that it was and that he was the author of it. In fact, Craig Keener argues that not only was John the son of Zebedee the author, but he oversaw all of it. You know, maybe some others were helping him write it, but he oversaw all of it, even chapter 21.
That's a big point, isn't it? Because a lot of people don't realize that it was quite common for a historian, particularly one representing a group, a community, to have secretaries and to have people who were helping put it together.
That's correct. Even someone as highly educated as Cicero, he had his own secretary, scribe, amanuensis, however you want to say it, but let's just call it a secretary. And a secretary wouldn't have been like, you know, we look at a secretary today. Hello, this is Cicero's assistant. Can I help you? It wasn't something
just
like
plan
that.
The calendar.
Right, exactly. So Cicero, as highly educated as he was in philosophy and in rhetoric and everything, he had his own secretary who penned these letters and letters that we had correspondence between him and Brutus's secretary. So Brutus would have a secretary who would respond to Cicero and write to Cicero. But they wrote to one another through these secretaries, and yet they were both highly educated. When we come to Paul in the New Testament, you have Paul's most admired piece of literature attributed to him, Romans, his letter to the church at Rome. And in chapter 16, verse 22, it says, I, Tertius, who write this letter, send you my greetings. So Tertius wrote this letter. So it could very well be the case that Paul had very lengthy discussions with Tertius. Tertius interviewed him, took down all these things, and then Tertius constructed Romans, and Paul read it and approved of it. Wow, Tertius, you make me look good. Thank you so much. You know, and Paul signs off for this thing, but it's written by Paul.
The apostolic imprimatur.
Yeah. And, you know, elsewhere, Paul says, like at the end of letters, I, Paul, write this greeting with my own hand.
Right. Why does he single that out?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's good reason to think that, and if Paul and Cicero could use it, why wouldn't Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John use some sort of a secretary to help them pen their gospels? At that point, it gets pretty difficult to say something like Ehrman and others would say that, well, the gospel authors couldn't have written those things because they weren't educated men, you know, with the exception of possibly Luke, you know. They weren't educated. They were fishermen, or Matthew being a tax collector. They couldn't have written gospels like that. Well, they could have had secretaries doing these things.
Oh. With respect to the question of what they thought they were writing, again, at this point, aside from the question of whether they are reporting accurately, how important is eyewitness testimony, first of all, in the Jewish context, and then in the Greco-Roman context, and then in terms of the apostles' own testimony to what they were doing in addressing those audiences?
Well, eyewitness testimony was regarded as quite valuable. You read Lucian's How to Write History, and he writes that in the middle of the second century. It's one of the few, very few treatments on how to write history that we have that has survived from antiquity. So this is actually titled How to Write History. And in there, he talks about, you know, eyewitness testimony. Thucydides in the 4th century BC talks about eyewitness testimony. You do put a premium on it. And if you don't have eyewitness testimony, you get it from people who heard from the eyewitnesses.
A few years ago, we had the chance to interview New Testament scholar Richard Baucom about his wonderful book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. I'd like to play a brief clip from that interview so that we can get your reaction.
Can we really get to the first century events through the documents that we have?
That's the thesis of the book, that we can. I'm basically arguing that the Gospels themselves are the best access we have to Jesus, and a very good access to the real Jesus. Because I think the Gospels consist of testimony. That's the reason for the title of the book, the Gospels as Eyewitness Testimony. And I think testimony is a kind of reporting which comes firsthand from people who participated in the events, which was very much what historians in the ancient world valued. The ancients thought you could only write history within living memory of the events. And that was because you had to either have been an eyewitness yourself, if you're the historian, or else you have met and interviewed and questioned eyewitnesses of the events. Luke's preface to his gospel is written the way ancient historians wrote prefaces to their historical works. It uses the same kind of terminology, same kind of claims about deriving from eyewitness testimony. So I think Luke certainly expects Theophilus, the man, his patron, he writes the gospel for, to value what he's saying because of its historical credibility, because it's based in eyewitness testimony, because it fits with whatever they know about history. So I don't think early Christians would have accepted these as sheer sort of documents dropped from heaven. They would expect them to be rooted in history and written and compiled with care. the Gospels are actually full of all kinds of little detail about places and people and the religious groups and the controversies, all kinds of stuff about the historical context in which the stories take place. So that's one way of verifying that the Gospels are credible from that geographical, historical context they claim to be about. And that, I think, is actually one of the most important historical methods of confirming testimony. You see, the term testimony, of course, implies that we can't actually verify independently everything the witness says. The whole point of a witness is they tell you something you don't know yourself. But what you can do is assess witnesses as either trustworthy or untrustworthy. And if you decide a witness is trustworthy, then you trust them. And this was the case in the ancient world. It's the case in ordinary everyday life when people tell us things, you know. If we've some reason to think they're not a reliable source, we doubt them. But on the whole, we accept what people say, and it works. It's what happens in a court of law. You know, you assess which witness is really trustworthy, and then you believe what he says. So I think this truth to the context, correspondence to the historical context at the time in which the stories are set, is a key method, which I think gospel scholars have rather neglected because they've been going with that other task, you know, trying to sort out, sort of thing the Jesus Seminar, when they vote on each saying of Jesus, each story about Jesus. You can't really do that. And what I'm trying to argue in the book, that actually there is good reason to suppose that these texts come from very close to Jesus. One of the things about the four Gospels compared with the Gnostic Gospels is that the four Gospels do situate Jesus very precisely in history, all kinds of historical detail. Jesus is connected with real history. The other Gospels are not interested in that at all. There, Jesus is really a purely mythic figure. The Gnostics aren't interested in history. So in that sense, there's no way of checking them in terms of historical context and so forth. We can say another thing, which is that it's not as though all our evidence for Jesus comes from Christian sources. We do have some Greco-Roman sources that refer to Jesus. The historians Tacitus and Suetonius refer briefly to Jesus. And we also have Jewish traditions which may well be independent of the Gospels, which say a few things about Jesus. So there is some corroborating evidence. But I think probably it's more impressive simply to look at the rapid growth of the Christian movement, the sort of things that everybody agrees were going on in the second century. You know, how did that start? It seems to me very unlikely that a purely legendary figure could have had that effect. Or indeed, if they were setting out to invent the Gospels out of nothing, why do we come up with these Gospels? Why do we come up against a Jesus who fits so well into the time and place that the Gospels put him? And the evidence for that is mounting all the time, because we know more and more about Judaism and other features of early first century society in Jewish Palestine, and that they do fit. So I think someone making it up would not get it right in that respect.
Michael, what do you make of some of the points that Professor Baucom made?
Well, I thought he made them very well. I agree with everything he said. It's hard to, you know, add more to that. I think he's done a lot of study on this and has put out some really great work on it. I applaud him.
One of the points that he makes in Jesus and the Eyewitnesses is the importance of names. And it never occurred to me how significant it is that names pop up in the Gospels. He argues there that very often you simply have someone healed, someone mentioned, someone who is there when Jesus is giving one of his sayings. But when you have a name mentioned, Baucom suggests that that is indicating the person who was an eyewitness from whom the gospel writer is getting that detail, who is, in fact, perhaps still alive. So you could go interview that person, or at least that person was a significant member now of the Christian community, like Lazarus, someone you could talk to or someone everybody had known about. What do you make of that?
From what I've seen in reading Plutarch, I think he's right on that. It's interesting to note that in Matthew and Mark, this woman who anoints Jesus is anonymous, and yet Jesus says, wherever the gospel is proclaimed, this story, what she did, will be told in remembrance of her, and yet her name isn't mentioned. Why is that? Well, could it be that it's because she was still alive at the time, and they wanted to protect her. And so that's why there was some anonymity. And then later on, when John's gospel was written, she had died by that point. And so John identifies her as Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus. What about the person in the garden of Gethsemane who cuts off the ear of the high priest's servant? Well, Matthew, Mark, Luke, it's not mentioned who that is. John, it's identified as Peter. Why is that? Well, maybe they were protecting Peter's identity until after he died. So I think that's curious. We can't prove that that's the case, but it's certainly
plausible.
That would
be an obvious charge to actually have a charge of violence against a soldier. That would have been a good, you wouldn't have to trump that one up.
Yeah.
Interesting. So to protect Peter's identity, it's not mentioned in the earlier Gospels.
Yeah, it's all plausible. Bauckham's had some significant contributions here in his work. The thing that you mentioned about names, well, one thing that I think is significant, he doesn't piggyback on the work of Tal Ilan, who did work on names as well and published on it. But he does his own study as well, and it seems to comport pretty well with what Tal Ilan came up with. And that is many of the names, the Jewish names in Roman Palestine at that point, or Judea. The Jewish male and female names, there were like only a handful, more than a handful, maybe a dozen or so names. Most were given that name, and you distinguish them from their family name. And these names, like Mary, Joseph, Eleazar, Lazarus, and Jesus, Yeshua, Joshua, and Simon, and Judas, and all these were just common names. In fact, it's like one out of every five Jewish women in Palestine at that time were named Mary. One out of every seven Jewish males in Palestine at that time were named either Simon or Joseph. So we would expect a bunch of these. They were named after the Maccabean or the Hasmonean brothers for the revolt that we read about in 1st and 2nd Maccabees, which is what we celebrate today as Hanukkah, right? It's the deliverance from the Seleucid or Syrian king. So these were the people that they were named after. Well, what's interesting, if these people, the gospel authors, were inventing these stories, why is it that the names that we find listed in the gospels for these people who lived in Roman Jewish Palestine, they're the same names that we find in that time, and they're listed in the same kind of degrees or percentages as we find in other literature of that period who are reporting these kinds of the population?
Interesting.
And we know this through the epigraphical evidence we have from the other literature, as well as the ossuaries, these bone boxes and inscriptions and tombs and things like this, where we know what these Jewish names were and the kind of percentage. We find the same percentages in the Gospels. This would be really difficult to duplicate if you were inventing these stories.
You mentioned, Michael, some of the dates for the four traditional Gospels. How do these dates compare, in your opinion, to the dating of the so-called Gnostic Gospels that Bauckham referred to?
Well, the Gnostic Gospels, I'd say the two of them that you're looking at that scholars would consider to be the earliest would be the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Peter. We know the Gospel of Peter was written prior to the year 200, but we don't know much past then because we don't really have anything that survives of that other than a few fragments containing 18 incomplete lines from the Oxyrhynchus papyri, which were dated, you know, around the year 200. And then you've got what's called the Achaemenid Codex, which is dated between the 7th and 9th centuries, or 600 to 800 years after Jesus. And that contains the bulk of what we have today of the Gospel of Peter. And most scholars think that the Gospel of Peter was familiar with the other four Gospels. And the kind of stuff it's got in the Gospel of Peter is far more dramatic than what we have in any of the Gospels. You know, it's like on Easter morning, you've got the people come to the tomb of Jesus, they line up by the tomb of Jesus, and the stone rolls itself away, and these two angels come out of the tomb carrying victorious Jesus on their shoulders. And when they come out, the heads of the angels go up to the clouds, but Jesus, not to be outdone by that because he's bigger, his head goes up above the clouds. And then his cross comes walking out of the tomb, following them. And this voice from God comes out from heaven and asks the cross, "Did you preach to the dead, those who are asleep?" And the cross answers, "Yes." Well, giant Jesus is followed or accompanied by his cross. This is part and parcel of some of the literature that was written in the second century, like the Shepherd of Hermas, the Ethiopic Apocalypse of Peter, and 4th Ezra. This is not the stuff that you find in the first century. So most scholars do believe that the Gospel of Peter is second century literature. In terms of the Gospel of Thomas, you know, a lot of skeptics like to place it sometime in the first century. The earlier you can get it, the better for them. But the majority of scholars today will place the Gospel of Thomas around the middle of the second century, and there's a tendency now to place it toward maybe, you know, toward the end of the second century, and that it is dependent on the Diatessaron, Tatian's Diatessaron, which was written around the year 170, 180. So, but anyway, most scholars do think that the Gospel of Thomas is dependent on the four Gospels. And those are the two earliest ones. Now, the others, they'll say, you know, these things are even later. Even Bart Ehrman, who refers to himself as a happy agnostic, who's bordering on atheism, he says that when you come to these non-canonical Gospels, these inform us more about what some Christians believed in the second and third centuries than what the actual Jesus was. And he goes on to say, hey, again, this is Ehrman. This is in his New Testament introduction. He says, look, if you want to know about the real Jesus, the best sources we have are the New Testament Gospels. And he says, this is not for theological reasons. It is for historical reasons, pure and simple. That's almost a quote.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
New Testament scholars are theologians, too. They have a theology, even though they often pretend to not be bringing their theology into it. But when you look at it, their theology is close to Gnosticism. And basically, it's not historical facts that matter. It's the meaning. It's not that Jesus rose bodily, but that it was an event that happened to the disciples. So downplaying the historical physicality of the resurrection and the miracles, it's not surprising that people with that kind of theological presupposition would want to make the Gospels late and the Gnostic Gospels early. So you basically have, as Elaine Pagels argues, this really interesting cacophony of Christian opinions, and then a bunch of male bishops got together and ran out the quote-unquote marginalized groups among the Christians. But you're saying that that doesn't fit the history.
Yeah, it's, you know, scholars, New Testament scholars will use what are commonly called the criteria of authenticity, the criterion of eyewitness reports, the criterion of multiple independent sources, the criterion of embarrassing sources, the criterion of unsympathetic sources, things like that. Those who want to date the Gospels late and these other Gospels earlier, well, that's pretty much the criterion of convenience. It's convenient for what they want to believe, and so that's what they do. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, they'll usually say, oh, we see this developing tradition that's going on, because the later you get, the more embellished accounts get, the more fantastic they become. And yet, then they want to take the Gospel of Peter and place that earlier. Or like John Dominic Crossan, he wants to take that and say the Gospel of Peter is based on an earlier gospel called the Cross Gospel and do that earlier than the four Gospels. And of course, that's just speculation squared is all it is. There's not a shred of historical evidence for that. But presuppositions come in here. If you don't believe in the miraculous, and that's Crossan, because he said in his debate with William Lane Craig that prior to the Jurassic period, God did not exist. And I've talked to another fellow of the Jesus Seminar. He calls himself a Christian, and yet he told me he doesn't believe that a God exists in any sort of like the Judeo-Christian sense. If a God exists, it's a force. He doesn't believe in any kind of afterlife whatsoever. And, you know, that we kind of get absorbed into the universe, maybe like a Buddhism, but he calls himself a Christian. So, you know, but if you reject the supernatural, you don't like this kind of stuff, then you got to come up with something, right?
Exactly. I mean, think of Gerd Ludemann, too, in his debate with William Lane Craig, where he is cheerfully defending his views against the resurrection. And then finally, as William Lane Craig refutes his arguments, throws up his hands and says, oh, I'm a Gnostic. You kind of begin to get a common thread here that there is a lot of mysticism, not just anti-supernaturalism, but also a kind of hyper-supernaturalism that doesn't like history very much when it comes to binding doctrinal claims to history.
Yeah, well, like John Adams once said, facts are stubborn things.
They kind of stay put. Again, that was Michael Lacona, professor of theology at Houston Baptist University and author of The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach. Folks, the Apostle Peter said we need to always be ready to give an answer to the one who asks. And one thing's for sure, if you talk about your faith these days, you're likely to get a lot of different questions. Are you prepared to answer questions related to why you worship the God of Israel as opposed to the others? Or why you treasure the Bible in contrast to all the other holy books? Are you ready to give an answer to your friend or coworker who's being told in college classes that Jesus was just a cynic philosopher? And are you ready to give an answer to your Aunt Alice who just watched a recent Jesus special on the Discovery Channel? Are you ready to address the doubts that may arise one day in your own heart when things in your life don't seem to be working out as planned? The Christian faith is not a blind leap. It's not rooted in some kind of mystical experience or life change. The gospel is, first of all, an announcement, a report of what has happened outside of us in datable history. Its truth doesn't depend on how it makes you feel or whether it works better than other life strategies. Either Jesus fulfilled the Old Testament prophecies or he didn't. Either he rose again on the third day or he didn't. If he didn't, then Christianity is a sham. But if he did, then he gets to tell you about the meaning of everything. I'm Michael Horton for the White Horse Inn. Be sure to join us next time as Mike and I continue this conversation and talk about issues related to the dating and reliability of the New Testament epistles.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.